What does it mean to be an American? How has that identity changed over time? Questions we'll examine this hour. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, amid the nation's fierce immigration debate, we want to discuss the idea of an American identity and how it has changed over the course of our country's history. It turns out, who we let into the country has been fraught from the days of our founding fathers and has always been bound up in politics. My guests, presidential historian Tim Walch and University of Iowa political scientist Renee Rocha. American identity in historical perspective. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What does it mean to be an American, and how has that identity changed over time? Those are questions we'll examine this hour. Today, it's a historical show, but also with a reason. We want to put this in historical context, the nation's fierce immigration debate going on right now, the idea of an American identity, and how that has changed over the course of our country's history. It turns out that who we let into the country has been fraught from the days of our founding fathers. It's always been bound up with politics. It's always been bound up with a lot of emotion. This is taken from YouTube, a woman at an IHOP getting very upset with Spanish being spoken.
It's your fault. It's your fault for doing that.
I clean office. I clean restroom. Fuck you, hey! Stop it! Stop it! I'm janitor.
We speak English in America.
Yeah, I speak English. Not good, but I speak English.
Okay. Emotion heavy there. Perhaps you've witnessed such a scene. We want to dig back through American history to see how unusual this is, to put it in some context, how we feel about that idea. Who is an American? What is an American identity? How that's changed over the decades in the history of this country. Joining us to do that, presidential historian Tim Walch, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tim, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you, Ben.
And Renee Rocha is with us, associate professor and director of Latino and Latina Studies at the University of Iowa, political scientist joining us for the very first time. Renee, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
This will be a more or less a chronological examination, though we'll jump a little bit back and forth with Tim, going back to the era, the days of our founding fathers, and Renee picking us up more in contemporary times, into the 60s. But I'm sure we'll do a lot of overlapping. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. So we're going to talk about the racial and cultural nature of our policies going back to the days of our Constitution, how it's changed since then, the Civil War, the 1880s, and so forth. Before we start, Tim, give us an overview of American identity chronologically. What, in terms of overarching themes, would you say we should look at when we go through some of these details?
Wow. Ben, I think we should start with the very first words of the preamble to the Constitution. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish. We the people, which people? Do we mean white Anglo-Saxon males from Great Britain or from the British Empire? Do we mean others? This was never really a thought, with a possible exception during the Adams administration at the turn of the 19th century, about aliens, outsiders, perhaps. And so we had the Alien and Sedition Acts. We were concerned about people corrupting the freedoms and liberties we had fought so hard to have. And really, immigration, the idea of people coming to this country, was a benign idea. We had plenty of land after 1803 with the Louisiana Purchase. We had so much land, we were seeking to populate it. But I don't think the Founding Fathers necessarily thought, well, gosh, what about people who speak other languages? What about people who have other religions? beginning in the 1820s, of course, we have lots of Irish people coming. They're Catholic. They're largely illiterate. There's some suspicion that they may not be loyal. We have Germans. Yes, they're Protestant, but they speak a different language. And they drink beer and they maybe should be distrusted, and they're clannish. So we've had this tension between the idea in this country that we want people to come. We have a policy of we the people. We're open. On the other hand, gosh, we'd sure prefer if they'd behave the way we want them to behave,
right.
That they would speak English and that they would have the same white Anglo-Saxon values that our founding fathers had. And in a way, the public school system that we established in the 1840s was intended to take those Irish and German immigrant children and mold them into young Americans. So going up to the 1840s, we've seen that immigration even then was a question of tension. We've opened the doors. And so many people in this country today, of course, if they follow ancestry or do their DNA test, find, my goodness, they have British roots, they have Spanish roots, they have maybe African roots as well.
So when we go back to the Founding Fathers, you mentioned the Alien and Sedition Act. So at the very earliest days, that defined immigrants?
Well, immigration policy was essentially not a federal issue until the 1880s. Essentially, it was left to the state. So if you arrived on a ship in the port of New York or in Boston or Baltimore or New Orleans, this was handled by state authorities. And so really beginning in the 1880s, when we nationally restricted the immigration of the Chinese to this country and how long they could stay, you don't have a federal policy. You do have questions of citizenship and statehood as defined by the Civil War, but you don't have the kind of federal policy until you begin in the 1890s when we begin to restrict the number of immigrants we're allowing.
What was it about the Chinese, the influx of Chinese immigrants? You mentioned the Irish, the
right.
German, the Chinese doing a lot to build this country, especially the railroads.
Right, exactly.
And why did that? The government see, or what was the pressure to limit the Chinese immigration?
I don't want to cast too broad a shadow on this, but of course we had a model, I think implicit model, of what the expectation of a typical American citizen would be, and it would be defined by a kind of an Anglo-Saxon heritage and culture and English language. And if you invite people in who are going to be hard workers, well, hard work was beneficial in terms of the construction of the railroad, but if they spoke a different language, a different culture, different foods and so forth, you were suspicious, and there was, of course, a racial tinge to it, too. They were a different race, and so the idea was we're going to restrict the number of Asians we're going to allow into this country. At the same time, again, with the 1880s, the railroads, of course, are constructed in the 1860s, but in the 1880s, then you see larger numbers of people coming from Italy, from Greece, from Eastern Europe, and again, a greater variety of languages. And of course, often congesting in large cities, so you have a clash of cultures in a very small space, and this caused a greater concern among those people who were largely in control of the power structure, who were, of course, white Anglo-Saxon males, who themselves come from, of course, immigrant stock. Granted, it was British immigrant stock, but they were the grandchildren of immigrants themselves. I always loved the line from FDR, I think in the late 1930s, when he addressed the daughters of the American Revolution. You know, there they were all decked out in their finery. And he started his speech by saying, "Fellow immigrants," which in fact is true. All of those people, whether they were, wealthy and white Anglo-Saxon or they'd come from a different part of the world, were descendants of immigrants. And we have made that something of a theme in this country. But on and off, we've restricted immigration. We've restricted it in the 1920s. We changed the law in 1965. And then going forward, we've constantly made modifications to it.
If you just joined us, Tim Walsh is with me, presidential historian. Rene Rocha is with us as well from the University of Iowa. As we put our American identity in the in historical context, of course, the nation's fierce immigration debate in our news weekly, daily, monthly, it's there. It's been there for many years, and it's likely to be there for many years to come. So we're trying to understand how we place our current time in the context of American history. Tim Walsh, take us up further into the beginning of the 20th century. You talked about the Italians coming, the East Europeans coming. So what happens as we get further into the 20th century?
And we have this interesting kind of conflict. Of course, people, at the same time, we're introducing the Chinese Exclusion Act, restricting the number of Chinese who can stay in this country and renewing this and preventing them from being citizens. We're raising money for the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty. And lest we forget, of course, the poem was added later, Emma Lazarus' great poem. But the poem goes, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." So we're restricting on one hand, and we're opening the door on the other. And so we are. I want to say bipolar, but we are doing things in opposite extremes. In 1891, we set up a Bureau of Immigration to begin to regulate at the federal level the number of immigrants we allow in the country, and that continues on. We're still concerned about these swarthy people of color, these Italians, these Greeks, these Poles who are coming. And there's a famous book published in 1916 by a kind of an upscale WASP named Madison Grant. Great name, Madison Grant. It's called The Passing of the Great Race. And his concern was that we were mongrelizing our culture by allowing all these people of color and culture to come into this country. And yet, quite frankly, the greatness of this country, as we historians look back on it, is the fact that we've been so open, that we've allowed people, not just people of color, but people of brilliance and skill and achievement to come here because their desire for freedom.
It is remarkable that you go back to a book written in
1916. That's right.
And that could be the theme that you just described, could be a book from today.
Yeah. Yes. I think there are people who might pick that book up and say, "I agree with everything that Madison Grant said." That's sad, but it's true.
A milestone in immigration and our identity in 1952. What was that, Tim?
Well, we had an act which restricted immigration. I'm trying to think of the name of the act. It was the McCarran-Walter Act. And again, after World War II, we have a large refugee population in Europe. People are coming to the United States. We want to, on the one hand, restrict the number of people who are coming. I think we were less concerned at that point about people coming from Southern and Eastern Europe as we were concerned about people who might have attitudes and views, communistic attitudes. And so we were restricting people based on their political views. Mm-hmm. So in 1952, caught up in the whole Cold War, you have the McCarran-Walter Act as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on a little bit further. I wanted to play a little archive audio from John Kennedy. This is a speech, and I don't know, there's another Immigration Act in 1965.
Coming 65, yes.
But this is from 63.
Right.
This is a speech he gave at the 50th annual meeting of the Anti-Defamation League in 63. John Kennedy reminding listeners that the U.S. was, in his words, a nation of immigrants. He wrote a book of the same title?
He did, a collection of articles. And remember, he's the first Catholic to become president of the United States. He was of Irish heritage. In fact, he was the great-grandson of immigrants.
Okay. And he wrote a book with that title, A Nation of Immigrants, later helped to establish a quota system based on migrant nationality. Let's hear a little bit of President Kennedy from 1963.
It is a proud privilege to be a citizen of the great republic, to hear its song sung, to realize that we are the descendants of 40 million people who left other countries, other familiar scenes, to come here to the United States to build a new life, to make a new opportunity for themselves and their children.
So this was a different era.
It was. In fact, I think, as you have a growth in terms of our economy and a need for additional workers, we changed our immigration policy to basically emphasize the reunification of families and seeking people with additional the skills we needed to move our economy along. So there was less tension in the 1960s, I think partly as a result of the fact that the anti-Catholic views that many people had were fading away because John F. Kennedy was accepted as a president. I think there was an openness. I think we've always aspired to be open, and we are very proud of our immigrant heritage and roots. There's hardly anybody who would deny if they have those immigrant roots. The problem is now that they're through through the door, do they close it behind those people who still want to go through it?
Right.
So the question is, and so we've always had a certain amount of restriction. What percentage of people are we going to allow? Well, first of all, what raw number are we going to allow? 100,000, 500,000 or whatever? And which nations are we going to allow to come to send people to this country?
So, Rene Rocha, I want to have you join in here. You've been listening there. Have we bringing up to the times that you focus on? 1965, you see the Immigration and Nationality Act. We played that cut from Kennedy. Where can you jump in this timeline of how we have thought about identity and who we let in?
Yeah, well, one of the things that Tim's bringing up at the end there is this connection between sort of labor market economics and immigration policy. And that's a really key part of the story, right? So we see that there's actually very little illegal immigration that's coming into the country in the 1940s and 50s and 60s because we have a very large, expansive guest worker program. Our immigration policy is very attuned to our labor market needs. And, you know, it's a long, complicated story, but what happens is in the 1960s, that large, expansive guest worker program largely closes. And so now you have a disjuncture. You have an immigration policy which is out of sync with our economic needs. And then that's going to just not really affect migrant flows, because migrant flows are going to be a function of those macroeconomic conditions in the United States and in countries that are sending. But since public policy is now out of whack, that immigrant population, largely legal in the 1940s and 1950s, now becomes illegal. And as Tim's suggesting, it becomes the first period in American history in which we have large-scale illegal immigration into the country.
So we've narrowed,
absolutely,
we've limited immigration here, but our economics tell us that we still need people, new blood, new families, workers in this country, Rene.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, but the issue is now that the population that's coming in is illegal, that creates a whole different system. That means that they're allowed to be denied certain political and civic rights. And more importantly, it changes the way people think about immigrants. So that there might have been that sort of anti-Irish, anti-Catholic hostility that's occurring in previous points in time. But now you have those same sort of perhaps anti-Latino attitudes that exist today, now coupled with a sort of legitimization by the government that's offered when that population is deemed as illegal and criminal. Although, you know, important point of clarification that being in the United States without authorization actually isn't a crime. It's a civil offense. But, people.
So the idea of enforcement changes in character quite a bit here.
Exactly.
Enforcement. Let's go to Anita in Ames. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Anita, coming up on a break, but I see you want to get in on our conversation. What do you want to say?
Wondered if the speaker today could talk a little bit about also what has happened with Native people,
right,
that they were not offered citizenship until 1924, and how that plays a role in thinking about citizenship and immigration in a whole different light. And so thank you for taking my call.
Anita, thank you so much for bringing that up. We're talking about the founding fathers, of course, the original people of this land. How were they thought of as Americans?
We the people didn't include Native Americans, nor did it include African Americans, nor did it include women. So the initial foundation of our country, as expansive and as aspirational as we might say the Constitution is, was quite restrictive. And of course, after the Civil War, we began to conduct a war almost of genocide against Native peoples and enforce them to live on reservations and to deprive them of basic rights. So we hardly can look back on all episodes of our past with a matter of pride. There's periods of tension toward every group that has ever arrived or every group that has been different from the model or the norm, which is white Anglo-Saxon males from Great Britain.
Rene, let me ask you about this, based on what Tim just said there. How has assimilation been thought of here? We have a new group, an influx of new immigrants here, and it seems to me that always the fear: will they form their own enclave? Will they really become part of the American fabric or not? Has that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, Tim could talk about some of the fears that we had of, say, like German immigrants who were coming in the early 1900s and fears of assimilation that would not happen at that point in time. And, you know, things like the widespread usage of German continued across generations at that point in time. That same process largely exists today. We see that There is a, you know, assimilation is a slow process. It may be generational between things like as you go from Spanish dominance to bilingualism to English dominance. But the process really mirrors some earlier things. In fact, if anything, it's a little bit speedier, I would say, today than it had been historically. A concern I would have is that what you have now is this sort of double whammy where you have things like distinctions based upon language that are also combined with differences of race or ethnicity. And that allows for a real kind of cementing of prejudicial attitudes towards this group, which is a little bit more difficult.
We'll talk about the clip I played at the beginning there, the woman being very upset at the IHOP. So talk about language here. What is – and not to discount that emotion, that whatever is being demonstrated there, and the internet is full of people ranting about non-English speakers in any public setting. You can find a lot of these here. So dissect that a little bit. Tell me what's behind that emotion. The fear, the rage?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things going on. I mean, I think there's a little bit of what we would call sort of social desirability, where you can't really say out in public that you're upset that immigrants are from Mexico or from Honduras or Guatemala, but you can be upset that they don't speak English. That's more socially acceptable. And so as a way of sort of focusing your outrage, that is a more acceptable form of expression. So I think that there's some kind of couching of other sentiments that's occurring when people express feelings like that. You know, and really people are mad about difference. And I think the reason that people are mad about difference is just you can't disentangle that from race. It's not just about culture or just about language or religion.
We had this idea in the 2016 election still being thought over. Is it really about economics, new immigrants taking away jobs, or the threatened culture? Tim, you have an idea about that?
Well, Renee's absolutely right. I think the challenge here, of course, is difference. And that is, how do we become comfortable with variety in this country, whether it's language or it's religion, you know, the hostility toward Muslims, again, non-Christians. So what you have is that challenge of the model that people have or the romantic notion of what it means to be an American, that somehow when their grandparents or great-grandparents got off the boat from Romania or from Italy or Greece, that they immediately began to speak English. They didn't. They spoke Greek, and they read Greek newspapers, and they read Italian newspapers, and we had Italian newspapers. We had Yiddish theater in this country. So we have used a multitude of languages. And Renee is right. There's been almost a hyper-pressure on Spanish-speaking people to either give up Spanish or speak it only at home. And, of course, we use the public school system. Yes, we do try to accommodate people and children of all languages as much as possible because we realize that if English is a second language, it's a challenge. That wasn't the case in the 19th century. The teacher spoke English. You better learn English quickly.
Do you have any stories of immigration?
Well, it's a wonderful story that some people...
We have less than a minute.
Okay. We'll talk about it after the break.
But okay, specific to Iowa here. We had communities here in Iowa that were...
The pressure during World War I against all hostility toward the Germans. If your name was Schmidt, you changed it to Smith. Of course, you didn't eat a Frankfurter, you ate a hot dog, and you did not speak German on the telephone. So the idea would be that you try to assimilate as quickly as possible. But we embraced, I mean, the Germans, it was heartbreaking for them. They had to give up so much of their culture, their kinder and their kerke, you know?
Tim Walsh, presidential historian, so many stories, insights. We always love having Tim on. Renee Rocha is with us for the first time. We're talking about the evolving American identity, putting a little bit of the fierce debate we're having over immigration, who gets in, who has to stay out, in historical context. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll hear from then-President Reagan, his remarks, the signing of a new law. We'll find out what that's about when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with presidential historian Tim Walch and Renee Rocha, associate professor and director of Latina Studies at the University of Iowa, looking at American identity through the decades, going back to the founding fathers, getting some really interesting insights about how it has changed, how we exclude people from that American identity or include them, and the various waves of immigrants that have come to our shores to begin their family histories. And we want to pick up, we're well into the 20th century. I wanted to pick up one of the milestones, more contemporary one, if I can, Renee, to have you explain a little bit about what was happening in the 1980s. Before that, here is President Reagan's remarks at a signing ceremony for the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. We've edited this audio for brevity.
Distance has not discouraged illegal immigration to the United States from all around the globe. The problem of illegal immigration should not therefore be seen as a problem between the United States and its neighbors. Our objective is only to establish a reasonable, fair, orderly, and secure system of immigration into this country, and not to discriminate in any way against particular nations or people. Future generations of Americans will be thankful for our efforts to humanely regain control of our borders and thereby preserve the value of one of the most sacred possessions of our people, American citizenship.
Renee Rocha, take us back to the 1980s. Put this in context.
Yeah, so back in the 1960s and 70s, what you saw is, again, that moving out of sync between our immigration laws and our labor demands, which led to a large illegal immigrant population. But we largely didn't have any type of enforcement. That illegal immigrant population was allowed to just come and exist without much intervention. So in 1986, President Reagan passes a Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act, which begins to start the process of immigration enforcement. It builds the modern sort of enforcement regime that we have today. As part of it, it offers some amnesty. So 2.something million illegal immigrants receive amnesty of the, you know, approximately 3 million that are estimated to be here at the time. But then we also begin to start securing our borders, building up the our Border Patrol and our Immigration and Naturalization Service bureaucracy. So, like, one important statistic is that, you know, at the time that Reagan passes IRCA, the budget of the Immigration and Naturalization Service is about $150 million. And today, the budget of Immigration and Customs Enforcement is about $6 billion.
Wow, that's a huge leap.
Yeah. And so this is the start. That process begins in 1986 with that effort to, quote unquote, humanely protect our borders.
Mm-hmm. Right. Tim, with the vast amount of time that you're looking at when you consider immigration and American identity, who, in any given time, who are the people who are most upset by immigration, open borders historically?
Well, I think it is true, and it kind of speaks to what Renee was talking about, and that is people who are undocumented are attracted here because there are economic opportunities for them to work. There are jobs for them to do, and there are people who are willing to pay them, perhaps under the table, but they are being paid. That having been said, there are also people who are upset because the jobs that they had in manufacturing, they had the right values. They might not have had the technical education or the skills to move up the social ladder, but they were good hard workers. And back in the 50s and 60s, they have perhaps a nostalgic view of how successful they were. And those jobs have disappeared. So they're angry that the jobs have gone overseas. They see other people coming into the country who are perhaps undocumented and using that opportunity to work in jobs that they themselves, that is the people who are upset, would not do, and roofing and agriculture and other types of jobs that are really very hard to do. And they become angry. They lash out. So the message of hostility that you often hear on cable channels, on certain radio shows and so forth, stokes that sense of resentment. They're declining and they're angry, and often they live in small towns and they don't necessarily know anybody who's mm-hmm. who's Spanish, or they don't know anybody who's African American, and so they hear these stories, they're ingesting this information, and it's stoking their apprehension.
So these are real concerns founded in economic realities and changing economic realities.
Well, see, an important point here is that, you know, they're not necessarily founded in economic realities in the sense that are these individuals in direct labor market competition with immigrants? And so, you know, economists have tried to search for whether or not there's some sort of, say, negative relationship between the wages of a native-born worker and the presence of a large immigrant labor force. And there's not, right? The only sector of workers that maybe sees these negative effects are black males who don't have high school degrees, so the very bottom of sort of the labor force. Sometimes economists have noted that they have some wage decline if they live in areas with large immigrant populations. Mm-hmm. So the question is, why, if the objective conditions aren't that of economic competition, are you seeing that resentment build amongst this group? Why are they misattributing right. their conditions to this population?
Mm-hmm. There's an irrationality to the whole process of anger and resentment toward undocumented workers.
I wanted to play a couple of contemporary audio clips from our news in recent years and have you react to this and perhaps place it in some historical context here. This is Steve King, Iowa representative in what is now the 4th District. It used to be the 5th District before redistricting took place in 2010. This is Steve King, Representative King from 2017, defending, if you remember this in the news, his widely condemned tweet in support of a far-right Dutch politician named Geert Wilders during an appearance on CNN.
I've said the same thing as far as 10 years ago to the German people and to any population of people that is a declining population that isn't willing to have enough babies to reproduce themselves. And I've said to them, you cannot rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies. You've got to keep your birth rate up and that you need to teach your children your values. And in doing so, then you can grow your population and you can strengthen your culture, you can strengthen your way of life.
Okay, so what do you hear in those words, Renee, from Steve King in March of 2017?
I mean, there's a particular definition he obviously have of what our way of life in America is. I mean, I would link back to some of the ideas that Tim was talking about in the first half of the show. There's a professor named Sam Huntington who wrote a book a few years ago called Who Are We? And in that book, he makes a distinction between what he calls settlers and immigrants. And he says, we're not really a nation of immigrants, right? We're a nation that was founded by settlers, white, Protestant. And that after the establishment of that society with a particular set of institutions and values, immigrants then came into it. And I think that's the same distinction that Representative King seems to be drawing in that statement.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another clip from our news in recent years. This is June of 2015. What happened then? Well, Donald Trump declared his candidacy to be president of the United States. Whatever time in history, Tim, I think you know this is one of the most well-known Trump excerpts. It happens to be the day that he declares his candidacy. This will go down in history. Whatever else happens, this will go down in history as one of the quotable quotes from Donald Trump in his candidacy, right?
Well, yeah, without question. I mean, it's sort of the hallmark. It's this, the statement that everyone said, don't make that statement. And he went ahead and did it.
Okay, here he is, June 2015, referring to some Mexican immigrants as rapists.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
So put this the successful candidacy, Renee, of Donald Trump in historical perspective. We had 8 years under the first black president, a president who celebrated the country's diversity. Is it a coincidence that we have a Donald Trump following a Barack Obama?
Absolutely not, right? I think that there would have been no other circumstance under which a person like Donald Trump would have been elected to the presidency. You know, if American history, especially American racial history, moves in this sort of cyclical process where there's these periods of progress and then sort of regression, you have emancipation of slaves, you have sharecropping, you have that system get eliminated, you have the return of Jim Crow. Jim Crow gets eliminated, you have the existence of the mass incarceration state. And so we have sort of a cyclical process happening here. We have the breakdown of barriers, the establishment of administration which is going to celebrate these themes of diversity, and then it's followed by an administration which is as hostile to those themes as anything that we've seen in modern times.
Mm-hmm. David from Iowa City asking, I want to remind our listeners, if you just joined us, Renee Roche is with us of the University of Iowa, Tim Walsh, presidential historian. David from Iowa City asks, if we were more welcoming to immigrants in the U.S., would they be less likely to form enclaves and more likely to assimilate? You want to tackle that,
I think,
Tim?
We have a naive and perhaps romantic notion of how quickly generations of immigrants assimilate. And they do assimilate, as Renee suggested earlier. They go through the process of speaking Spanish or speaking their native language to being bilingual, to having children who speak primarily English and so forth. And as time goes on, multiples of generations, what I'd like to ask everyone to remember is, with the possible exception of the Irish who spoke a guttural English at the time, everyone who arrived here was speaking another language, that their great-grandparents and grandparents gradually shifted to English because that was how they were able to find work. That was how they were trained in the schools. We have to have more confidence that we do merge toward we the people as one people. The apprehension is that if we allow people into the country who are not cookie-cutter versions of what we hope they will become several generations later, that we want to reject them. I think most of those people who are coming in who are undocumented have all the aspirational goals that any good American citizen would want. And that's – we need to remember that.
Mm-hmm. And I think the caller is pointing on an irony here, right? So if you – have a sort of restrictionist set of policy preferences, but you also want immigrants to assimilate, right? And so, but if you want immigrants to assimilate, you can't then hold a series of preferences that are going to promote policies that are going to make immigrants withdrawn from society, distrustful of political and civic institutions, unwilling to sort of leave their neighborhoods, report crimes, send their children to public schools, right? Some of the things that we know happen in areas of really sort of intense immigration enforcement.
Can you imagine a world where we have, to the degree that we don't have control of our borders, that we have more control of our borders, that this can coexist, a country that celebrates lawful immigration? I mean, that is the chief complaint, is that we don't have anything against immigration. We have something against people who legally immigrate, families who legally immigrate and say, I did it legally. You didn't do it legally.
We do want to control the number of people who come over and the process in which we come. We're not saying, I think, as some might suggest, in building walls, whether it's across the Canadian border or the Mexican border, that we're saying out, no more. What we're saying is we want to control the numbers. The problem is, as Renee suggested earlier, there are economic forces that are greater than our ability to have a federal policy that can control the flow. So that as long as there are jobs that will not be done by available American workers, and with unemployment hovering around 3%, we've got large numbers of agricultural jobs and construction jobs, and we need workers to do those. So if we don't reintroduce a guest worker program, and you continue to have the political situation you find in Central America, you're going to have people being pushed out of their countries by fear and attracted to the United States by economic opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And, I'd say that our borders are pretty much largely under control because they're subjected to these economic forces. Illegal immigration into the United States is net negative in 2009 because the 2008 recession happened, right? And so these flows are actually pretty predictable. One of the things that immigration enforcement does is it actually sort of disrupts that natural labor flow that's occurring on the basis of economics and in some ways actually sort of mucks it up and makes the process sort of less predictable and less routine.
Mm-hmm. Back to the point you made earlier, Tim, to expand on schools, public schools, and gets back to our conversation about assimilation, because, of course, public schools are – it's a period of great change in this country right now for public schools and the introduction of charter schools and where the money should go, how much should we invest in our public school system, which has been around for a long time. This is a an instrument of assimilation that has been very important in the past?
Without question. And of course, all assimilation and in integration starts with the family. And if the family has values that aspire for their children to do better than they did, and they see the school as an opportunity for the child to acquire the education they need, that school serves as an engine of homogenization into American citizenship. So that it does take, though, several generations. It's not something where you can snap. There isn't any sort of instant process of becoming an American, going from somebody from a small village, say in Germany or Mexico, to becoming an American overnight. And so it's a question of having the patience to understand that history tells us that this is a multi-generational experience. And anyone, by the way, who's also used science and gone through the DNA process and checked their own ethnic heritage through 23andMe or whatever, they find, my goodness, there's been all kinds of blending and intermarriage. And so that many of us are of multitude of different ethnic cultures and traditions. And so we need to have a certain wisdom that allows us to understand that the present isn't so extraordinary in terms of circumstances, that we're getting overly hyper about it.
Yeah. What about the present in historical perspective in terms of how our dominant political parties represent certain positions in this immigration debate? Have the Democrats and the Republicans always represented these positions? Has that evolved in recent decades?
Well, when we go back and we look at the 1960s, we actually see a little bit of a flip. The Republican Party at that time is a little bit less concerned with sort of stoking nativist sentiments, and they're more concerned about business interests. And there are perhaps no greater proponents of a large importation of unskilled labor into the United States than business interests, right, who sort of mm-hmm. need that labor. Democrats at the time, largely under the pressure of labor unions, are sort of opposed to really an open immigration policy, because those immigrant workers are going to compete with low-skilled native workers who they want to unionize and they want to improve working conditions for. In some ways, where immigrant labor can act as scabs. And so the parties actually are sort of flipped in their preferences
in
the 1960s.
When and why did that flip?
What you see is, you know, I think one of the key events are politics in California in the 1990s. Pete Wilson's the governor at the time. He's in some political trouble, and he decides to hitch his wagon to a series of nativist propositions that are in the California ballot. These are things which are going to make it illegal for the state to provide services to undocumented immigrants. Using county hospitals, that kind of thing. There's another proposition that will make it illegal for public schools to teach bilingual education. And there you get this real connection between Republican Party politics and nativist attitudes. It works for Pete Wilson in the short term. It doesn't work out well for the Republican Party in California in the long term. But then we see that type of strategy get mirrored by other politicians in other states and then eventually nationalized.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes.
Yeah, I do think
left.
That there's
–
well, ahead, there is that belief, I think apprehension, and maybe it's not articulated by the Republican Party, but the notion is the idea is the more immigrants you allow into the country, the more Democratic voters you eventually create, and that by the year 2050, I think we're going to become a majority-minority country, and in terms of people of color will be a majority of the population, and Republicans seeing themselves becoming a smaller and smaller minority want to prevent – the number of immigrants coming into the country, or at least that's one supposition one might have as to why Republicans would at this mm-hmm. point oppose additional immigration.
Mm-hmm. We have this back and forth, it seems, over the years between globalism, embracing globalism, and isolationism. Does that match up with our back and forth, the way we deal with immigration policy and enforcement, Renee?
I mean, you know, tensions with globalization, I think, are a big problem. I think that sort of goes back to some of the things that Tim was talking about earlier about this decline in certain sectors. And maybe these aren't actually the sectors in which immigrant labor is largely being imported, but they're economic sectors that are in decline, and that causes frustration, and then that causes sort of resentment right. towards those towards new populations, right? So I think those forces of globalization, even if they're occurring in sectors in which immigrant labor is not readily utilized, like manufacturing, can still explain why people think the things they think about immigrants.
Yeah, I do think they resent. There's a resentment in large parts of the country for things like NAFTA, the idea that somehow they lost their jobs to assembly plants in Mexico. And the idea is if we just restricted or ended NAFTA and created tariffs, that those jobs would move back to the United States. No, they'd move to China or Indonesia or someplace else. They're not necessarily coming back to the United States. So that we're looking for a simple answer to a complex problem. And the answer is wrong. So the bottom line here is that we do live in a global economy, and so that we need policies that are more rational as it approaches where people are being attracted to in terms of job opportunities and what jobs they're willing to do and so forth. Mm-hmm.
With all the historical insights you've given us this hour, does it give us any indication of where we're going from here when we look at American identity, where we may be in the future?
The most important thoughts? To remember is the problem we face, and it's a challenge, there's no question about it, but how rare is it for a country to face a problem of too many people wanting to come to the country as opposed to countries where people are trying to escape tyranny and oppression? We are the nation that has been the beacon for the rest of the world. We are the nation that everyone aspires to come to. And so they are coming for economic circumstances, but they're also coming for purposes of freedom. They are seeing that lamp by the golden door the Statue of Liberty has. So mm-hmm. we can't forget that. We are a great nation because people want to be here.
Mm-hmm. Renee, concluding remarks. We have 30 seconds or so for you.
And Tim suggested there's this tension between our values on paper and our action in practice. Mm-hmm. And I think that tension has always been there historically. It's here today, and I think it'll be here tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you very much for giving us an important historical perspective on American identity amid this fierce immigration debate that we've had in this country and will continue to have in the years to come as we look at history. The tension's always been there and will remain there, we can assume. Renee Rocha, Associate Professor and Director of the Latino and Latina Studies at the University of Iowa. Tim Walsh, Presidential Historian, retired Director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. This was a good hour. Thank you very much for putting some of the news in a historical context, Tim and Renee.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and help today from Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, tomorrow we'll be discussing immigration because it's Politics Day, and that is very much in the news. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.